Okay, this is case number 78325, Glass versus Select Portfolio, I apologize, I read the wrong case. It's case number 78077, Gallardo Resendez versus Ely. We have Mr. Meyer representing the appellant, Mr. Levitt representing the respondent. Mr. Meyer, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I intend to try to reserve 5 minutes, although...
Okay. Well, you'll hear a little beep. You'll hear a beep when it gets to 5 minutes, so if you can kind of wrap up then, you can reserve the balance of that time then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Meyer, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael Cave of Meyer, registration number 13379, and I represent the appellant, Pedro Gallardo Resendez. This appeal arises out of a judgment entered by the trial court after erroneously applying Nevada law with respect to several related but distinct discovery rules, each one of which materially affected the substantial rights of Mr. Gallardo Resendez, and each one of which alone justifies remand for a new trial. First, in direct violation of this court's holding in FCH 1 v. Rodriguez, the court erroneously allowed Dr. Lanzkowski, a treating doctor, to testify for the first time at trial about new undisclosed medical opinions, and two, to review and provide opinions for the first time at trial about medical records and bills he had never seen before. This testimony included not only new opinions about the need for future surgeries and the cost of such surgeries, but also the reasonableness and necessity of medical bills and treatment that were never part of Dr. Lanzkowski's file. Second, in direct violation of NRCP, or what was at the time NRCP 16.1A1C, and this court's holding in Pizarro Ortega v. Cervantes Lopez, the court erroneously allowed Dr. Lanzkowski to testify about future surgery costs which were never disclosed and were required to be identified as part of Mr. Ely's calculation of damages. In its rulings, the court erroneously construed and applied what was then NRCP 16AC3 and rules concerning pretrial disclosures, and in doing so, interpreted those rules so broadly so as to render meaningless the application of other rules of evidence. Specifically, Mr. Ely suggests that this court should interpret the same rule such that a failure to identify any objection to pretrial exhibits for any potential reason thereby acts as a waiver of requiring a party to comply with the means and methods by which evidence may be used or introduced at trial. Finally, the court erroneously allowed evidence of Mr. Gallardo's Resendez's alcohol use for purposes of proving he was intoxicated at the time of the accident. Specifically, the court allowed in evidence that he was arrested and allowed the use of a never-disclosed arrest report that had never been provided or disclosed for purposes of the case for the purpose of showing that Mr. Gallardo Resendez was intoxicated at the time. I want to handle each one of those, but I want to go back to the first issue, if I can, and focus the court's attention most specifically on issues one and two. And that first issue is the NRCP 16.1 and this court's opinion in FCH 1, which clearly prohibited the scope of the testimony elicited by Dr. Lanzkowski. In FCH 1, this court held that a treating physician need not provide an expert report so long as the opinions to be provided at trial were formed during the course of treating the plaintiff. And two, even if an expert report is not necessary, the plaintiff must still disclose to the opposing party any documents the treating physician reviewed in forming his or her opinions. Now, the record in this case demonstrates that neither one of these elements was satisfied to allow the scope and the breadth of the testimony of Dr. Lanzkowski. Plaintiff here erroneously thought to introduce brand new surgical opinions when Dr. Lanzkowski was generally endorsed to testify about Mr. Ely's prognosis as formulated during care. However, the record is clear that Dr. Lanzikowski was never endorsed as anything other than a treating doctor. There's not a single reference in any of his records or records from any other providers made part of his file that identify or reference any need for recommendation for surgery, including neurosurgeon Dr. Garber, to whom Mr. Ely was referred, and of which the records are devoid of any mention whatsoever of any type of future surgery. Second of all, Dr. Garber only saw the plaintiff once, okay, and he saw him in 2017, well after, almost a year after, or I should say about 7 months after Lanzikowski stopped his treatment with the plaintiff. It should be noted that Dr. Lanzikowski actually never even saw Mr. Ely in clinic. He saw him on only three occasions, and on each one of those occasions, they were all for the administration of either lumbar medial branch blocks or radio frequency ablation. He provided absolutely no clinical follow-up. He never saw Mr. Ely before those injections, and he never treated him in a clinical setting with respect to anything related to the cervical or the thoracic spine. The way that the testimony was allowed to be entered in this case, literally the first time when Dr. Lanzikowski got up on the stand, also prohibited the defendant from being able to adequately challenge the qualifications of Dr. Lanzikowski to offer such opinions as an anesthesiologist or pain management doctor. While the record and we identified objections to those qualifications, we were never allowed to develop arguments or seek to challenge or limit the testimony of Dr. Lanzikowski, because the opinions that were given at trial, the defendant or appellant here had absolutely no notice of whatsoever from any type of medical doctor or any of the expert disclosures or rules of court that are required in order to put a defendant on notice of those types of opinions. Now, the appellee suggests that Mr. Gargano-Resendez was placed on notice in 2014 with respect to a need for surgery when there was a reference to such in the request for exemption from arbitration and a reference to such in his discovery responses. However, and those were back in 2014. However, FCH1 and thereafter Pizarro, when read together, those cases do not simply allow an attorney who cannot, as juries are instructed, arguments and statements of counsel are not evidence. Attorney's statements about a need for surgery or even a party's statement about need for surgery cannot and does not substitute for the expert disclosure requirements set forth in Rule 16.1. And if, in fact, there was some sort of medical opinion from any one of Mr. Ely's doctors back in 2014 that he required this surgery, that should have been supplemented as far back as 2014, when in fact
Mr. Meyer, Justice Stigler, didn't your own expert verify that there were records from Dr. Lanzikowski's clinic that would suggest surgical treatment? Didn't your own expert testify about that?
He did say that during trial, Your Honor, and I believe, unfortunately, the record isn't. That was never followed up on or was not explored further. What I believe he was referencing was there were referrals in the records to two different neurosurgeons for a surgical consultation. One was with Dr. Thalgott, and the other one was with Dr. Garber. The problem is that neither one of those records in any way, shape, or form identify any need for surgery, any recommendation for surgery or anything that could reasonably even be gleaned from a neurosurgeon's perspective. In fact, there's nothing even from Dr. Lanzikowski's records that would reference or even indicate any type of need for, or recommendation for surgery.
Mr. Meyer, so, isn't another problem, the how can we tell what the jury did? Because we have a general verdict. So maybe that's all pain and suffering. Maybe that doesn't even go to surgery. I mean, how can we distinguish when you have a general verdict that I believe you approved of?
So I believe that the evidence, when looked at in its totality, okay, if you look at it, the past medical damages separately from the future medical damages, Dr. Lanzikowski, and I'm going to address your question in sort of two parts. The first one being that Dr. Lanzikowski was allowed to introduce medical bills, which we believe there was an evidentiary basis for the jury to include those in its past award of medical damages. There is the only basis by which we believe that the record supports that the jury could award future damages is in the context of this need for future care that was never ever disclosed in any type of calculation for damages or anything of that sort. Absent, had Dr. Lanzikowski been constrained to the rules of disclosure and been constrained to what he was allowed to testify to, there would have been little to no basis at all for even an award of future pain and suffering or even a general.
Don't you waive that? Because before the jury was excused, you allowed that verdict to be recorded into the record on a general form, not with specific interrogatories. That's something that when that jury came back, certainly you could have objected to it and asked them to delineate what you're asking us to do here on appeal.
And we did not do that at the time, but what I would submit to the court is that the failure to do that doesn't act as a waiver to the error, the clear legal error that was occasioned by the presentation of the evidence up until that time, which the presentation of that erroneous evidence reasonably provides a basis for the damage award in this case.
What I'm asking you is, we could totally agree with you and say it was error, but how do we know that it affected the jury's verdict given the general form without interrogatories, which is what you're parsing out here?
Sure. Well, I guess I would say and just reiterate that had this testimony of Dr. Lanzikowski not been allowed, there's not any evidence in the record that would suggest that there would be a future damages award. There would be nothing in the record from an expert, okay, that would form a basis for a future damage award anyway.
But what about didn't your expert, Dr. Romaldi, say that this plaintiff would have a lifetime of pain and suffering? That's a future award of pain and suffering right there. Wasn't that the testimony, or am I reading it wrong?
Your Honor, I my recollection is that was the testimony of Dr. Lanzikowski. That's at least where the testimony started from. Dr. Romaldi, I believe, may have said he has conditions that certainly that he could have pain from into the future. But Dr. Romaldi specifically testified that those pain complaints would not have been caused by this accident. So if you take away Dr. Lanzikowski's testimony, even if Dr. Romaldi confirmed that he would have pain into the future, Dr. Romaldi qualified that by saying, well, none of that was from any injuries that were caused by the accident. And Dr. Romaldi potentially would not have even had to testify about those types of things had Dr. Lanzikowski been properly precluded from eliciting or from giving that type of testimony on direct examination, or I should say in plaintiff's case in chief. I know I have about 43 seconds here. I want to just address, if I can, the compounding error in this case in violation of the Pizarro-Ortega case. I think it's the record is self-evident and clear, and I believe it's undisputed, in fact, that the plaintiff failed to identify any future surgery costs in his calculation of damages and in accordance with Pizarro and Rule 16.1, it was clear error to allow that type of testimony to come in for the first time at trial. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer, we asked you quite a few questions, so we're going to add 2 minutes to your time for rebuttal, and we'll give Mr. Levin an additional 2 minutes in his response. So if the court clerk would make that change, I would appreciate it. On the timer, Mr. Levin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thanks the court. Andrew Levin on behalf of the respondent, James Ely. I just want to respond to something really quick that was just said. Now, I'm looking at Volume 8, page 1480 of the jury transcript. When the question was asked whether Dr. Rimaldi, the defendant's expert, indicated that there were records that would indicate surgical treatment, there was some kind of vague answer. So here's the question I asked him. Okay, and again, this is on page 1480, Volume 8. So the medical records do state that he needs surgeries. And this is Dr. Romali's response. Answer, there are medical records that came from Dr. Lanskowski's clinic that would suggest surgical treatment. So even their own expert recognized through the medical records in this case that there were records that the plaintiff, Mr. Ely, needed surgical treatment. Now, on this calculation of damages argument, the need for future surgeries that they say was never disclosed, okay, and pretrial correspondence, before this case even went to trial, we sent letters to the insurance company telling them that he's going to need surgery. And the arbitration exemption, we specifically put in there, he's going to need surgery. Now, the answers to interrogatories, and this is Volume 5 of the Appellant's Appendix, page 781. Specifically, the answer to interrogatory was, this is interrogatory number 27, it's page staff 781. These treating providers will also testify regarding the disabilities, the need of future surgery, and other matters pertaining thereto. I don't know how much clearer that can be. And then to even add more in response to interrogatory number 32, right, we tell the defendant, and this is volume 5, page 783, my future damages will be the cost of surgeries for my neck, mid-back, low back, as well as injections, physical therapy, surgery center costs, and other related treatment. Now, this is in addition to the 16.1 disclosures. This is in addition to the what we listed Dr. Lanskowski would testify to, the nature and extent of Mr. Ely's injuries, whether the medical bills in this case were reasonable, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know what else a plaintiff could do to put a defense attorney on notice that, look, we're claiming future damages for surgeries for the neck, mid-back, and low back, as well as injections, physical therapy, surgery center costs, and other related treatments. So when they say there was nothing in the record that would suggest that, and by the way, these were verified answers to interrogatories in April of 2015, 3 years before the trial even started.
But Mr. Levitt,
did you provide
defense with the computation of the future damages pursuant to 16.1A1C?
We did not put a specific number for the future damages. Now, but that is easily cured because on Volume 7, and I'll read it, when I asked Dr. Lanskowski during the trial, okay, I says, what is, and this is Volume 7, page 1206, what is the cost of a surgery like that? Mr. Myers, objection, foundation. OK, Okay, that was the only objection that was ever made to the cost of these surgeries. The question, are you familiar with the cost of these surgeries? Answer, intimately. This is Dr. Lounskowski's testimony during the trial. Volume 7, page 1206. Question, when you say intimately, what do you mean? Answer, you know, I've been doing plaintiff's work and defense work. I've been reviewing bills for 20 years in the community. This surgery, on average, soup to nuts, is about $150,000. No objection from the defendant. Question, okay, so it's going to be a $150,000 surgery to take him out of the pain. Answer, well, I'm just talking about his neck. We still have the thoracic spine. Now, Dr. Lounskowski went on at the trial to talk about the cost for the thoracic spine, the neck surgery, and the lower back surgery without any objection from the defendant. The defendant, even though they stated in their answering brief that they objected to the cost of the surgery, that was only after Dr. Lounskowski had completed his testimony. So any failure to list a specific number, basically guess and say, you know, it's $100,000, $150,000, they waived that objection, Your Honor, when they did not object during the trial on those specific questions. Dr. Lounskowski testified to the cost of those surgeries without any objection from the defendant. The only objection during that whole line of questioning was foundation, leading, and foundation. And we laid the foundation, and so those objections were waived. Now, not only that, right, when I cross-examined Dr. Romaldi, he specifically testified that, without objection, by the way, when I asked him how much would this surgery cost, he said between $130,000 and $140,000. How much would the lower back cost? $180,000 to $200,000. His guesstimate, or estimates, again, without objection from the defense, were $90,000 higher than what Dr. Lounskowski testified to. So their rights weren't materially affected. They knew we were going to ask these questions, and in fact, they never objected to it, and their own expert, you know, on the case law, his expert's estimates for the surgery were $90,000 higher than Dr. Lounskowski. So their substantial rights were never affected. And one of the things that they thought was important in that case is that the defense attorney objected. In other words, when they went to introduce the cost of a surgery, they were undisclosed. In other words, they didn't put a specific number. The defense attorney objected. In this case, there was no objection. The only time this argument was ever made was the last day of trial, right before we broke. He brought it up, and Judge Hardy's like, well, I thought we were talking about medical bills. Now you're talking about surgery costs. So all of that testimony came in unobjected. It came in through their own experts. So even if there was a deficiency, it was cured by Dr. Romali's testimony. So, but one of the things that the court, you know, in that FHC case and the other one, was the defendant's inability to contest the reasonableness of the amounts. And you can't say that you weren't able to contest the reason. And by the way, this is a discretionary standard, whether the judge should exclude it or not. And Judge Hardy exercised his discretion and allowed it because they didn't take anybody's deposition. They didn't take a single deposition of any doctor. But anyway, if they're unable to contest the reasonableness of the amounts, and in this case they were. And in fact, Dr. Romaldi's estimate, like I said, was $90,000 higher. So they never objected to this testimony coming in. So it's waived.
So is that a plain error? Are you saying that we should do a plain error review then on this? Just a plain error review, since they didn't object.
Exactly, Your Honor. There was no objection, so it's in. It came in. It's evidence. And so the answer is yes, Your Honor. So once – now, if he would object and said, hey, wait a minute, this was never disclosed, you never gave me a calculation of damage, I don't even think that the defendant knew that there was no calculation of damage until he started reviewing the file during the trial.
Well, Mr. Levitt, that kind of leads me to my question, listening to the history. I appreciate both attorneys kind of – briefing us what happened. Was there any motions in limine filed by Mr. Gallardo Hernandez before the trial started on these issues regarding the cost of the surgeries or these any of these other damages testimony?
No, there was not, Your Honor. They did file a motion in limine back in 2016 to so the answer is no, Your Honor, but there was one motion in limine that was filed to prevent the plaintiff from introducing any medical records since the discovery cutoff. That motion was denied, and the judge reopened discovery because the plaintiff was still treating. The case got continued numerous times because he was still treating. But in answer to your question, no, there were no motions in limine that were filed relating to, there were no motions in limine filed relating to any discovery issues. All of these close of discovery and all of these discovery issues are all came up after the trial. And they're really irrelevant because they stipulated to allow all of the medical records in. So I don't know what the point was of arguing all of that discovery motion or the close of discovery arguments because everything was stipulated in. Now, let me just be brief with these medical bills, okay? And again, this is an abuse of discretion standard. So the medical bills, there were four pretrial disclosures, okay? Because the trial kept getting continued. The plaintiff was still treating, and so we had to supplement those disclosures. Not one time did they ever object, okay? We had to supplement pretrial memos. And again, this is for just the medical bills, and the medical records. Not one time did they ever object. Now, in their brief, you know, in one of the briefs, they said, well, we did object. So, again, I went and pulled the transcript, and this is volume 7, page 1233. The court, Judge Hardy, asked Mr. Myers specifically, did you make any objections to plaintiff's pretrial disclosures pursuant to NRCP 16.1A3C? Mr. Meyer. Not with respect to the bills. This is on page, volume 7, 1235. The court, I asked him a question. Mr. Myers answer, we didn't make any objections to the pretrial disclosures on the basis of admissibility. So I don't know what he's talking about when he says that, you know, you have to make objections. Every time I've ever done one of these, you submit pretrial disclosures, the defense attorney, they send over their objections, hearsay, irrelevant, whatever it is. In this case, there were none. The judge determined that those medical bills automatically came in because they never made any objections. Now, even without that, though, let's say that the Judge Hardy excluded all of the medical bills. But when Dr. Rimaldi was on the stand, right, again, this is their expert. He testified without objection, okay? He said that the treatment in this case was necessary. In other words, he didn't have a problem with any of the treatment. He just said it wasn't related to the accident, that he just coincidentally had all of these issues after the accident. But he did say the treatment was necessary for his injuries, and he said that all of the medical bills were reasonable and are what are customarily charged in the community. So even if there was errors with Dr. Lanskowski, and they want to jump all over Dr. Lanskowski, he's not qualified, blah, blah, blah. Their own expert testified that the medical bills were reasonable and necessary and that the treatment was necessary in this case. And they can't, by the way, in all of their moving papers, they never addressed that. They never addressed the fact that their very own expert basically made the plaintiff's case. And they never objected to any of that line of questioning. When I asked Dr. Rimaldi, I asked him, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, are the medical bills in this case reasonable and customarily charged? His answer is yes. The surgery costs, are those reasonable? Yes. In fact, he was $90,000 higher. He testified that Mr. Ely was injured. He testified that the findings, by the way, there were six different MRIs in this case. There were three, one of his neck, mid-back, and low-back. And then 2 years later, there was another set of MRIs that actually showed all of his conditions worsening. But he said the finding, this is Dr. Rimaldi, their expert, the findings on the six MRIs would be pain generators. And the treatment was necessary and it was just not all related to the accident. In other words, their own expert came in and said, look, he was hurt. Some of this treatment is related to the accident, but all of this other subsequent treatment is just you know, degenerative, and it's not from the accident because that's what, you know, Dr. Romaldi does. Now, Your Honor, back to the lifetime of pain and suffering, that was a question that was asked to Dr. Lounskowski from Mr. Myers. When Mr. Myers was cross-examining Dr. Lounskowski, he said, look, he says, if he doesn't get these surgeries, he's going to be in a lifetime of pain. Dr. Romaldi agreed that all of the MRIs in this case, all of the findings are pain generators. In other words, he said, well, yeah, you can have surgery to fix it, but it's not from the accident. So there was never a dispute that Mr. Ely was injured, and there was never a dispute that he was injured and that all of these findings were pain generators. Now, back to the future damages. Your Honor asked a question about the verdict form. They never objected to the verdict form. Now, in the pattern rules, right, or the pattern jury instructions, there's a verdict form, and I'll hold it up right here. This is the book. And there's a space here, past medical expenses, future medical expenses. And this is a plaintiff or defense. You can use this. In this particular case, we just used one for past and future. We didn't break it down, future medical expenses, past medical expenses. Counsel in one of the briefs says, well, what do we got to have, a verdict form for everything that could possibly occur? This is just a standard verdict form from Nevada jury instructions. But they want to argue that, hey, wait a minute, the future damages that the jury awarded, those had to have been for surgical costs, even though there's nothing to base that on. In fact, just the opposite. The surgery costs were a lot more than $225,000. The jury gave him $205,000 in past damages for his past pain and suffering. By the way, this case took 5 years to get to trial. And then they gave him $225,000 in future damages, which is not unreasonable. And it was from pain and suffering or a lifetime of pain, however you want to call it. But they had a chance, and they never objected. They could have used their own verdict form. In fact, he had one sitting on his desk during the trial of the one I just pointed to, and they didn't use it. Now, so there was substantial evidence of future pain and suffering, and it had nothing to do with the surgical costs. They just want to put that on there and a chance to try and, you know, get the verdict reversed. The verdict came back, and if they truly believe that there was an error in the verdict, your Honor's right, they could have said, hey, wait a minute, you guys gave him $225,000. We think that some of that was for future surgery costs. Can you clarify that? Judge Hardy could have sent them back, and they could have clarified it. He didn't. He let them all go home, and now we're sitting here guessing, speculating, what the jury returned their future damages for of $225,000, where that doesn't add up to any of the expert's surgical costs, by the way. So it must have affected the substantial rights of the aggrieved party, and it didn't in this case. Now, I just want to – the DUI is a non-issue, but since he brought it up, anyway, I'm out of time, but the jury didn't find punitive damages, and he conceded liability. They admitted liability. So the DUI is it's a non-issue, Your Honor. And by the way, there's nothing to reverse the past damages. In other words, they don't even argue anything with the past damages, so there's no issue with the past damages. And thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Okay, Elizabeth, did you add another 30 seconds to Mr. Myers' time, so I want to keep it as even as I possibly can. And so, okay, Mr. Meyer, you may proceed.
Mm-hmm. I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor. A couple things I'd like to address. One of the questions Your Honor asked was, were there any motions in limine that were filed with respect to future calculation of damages? And that question the answer to that question is no. And the reason why there were no motions in limine filed with respect to that, because it was never a disclosed opinion. It was an undisclosed opinion that there was no reasonable basis in any of the medical records at all for the defendant to even guess or speculate that there would be a future surgical recommendation.
Well, why didn't you take why didn't you take the doctor's deposition? You could have pinned him down at the deposition to his opinions and what happened there. Why didn't you do that?
So one of the reasons, and this is sort of a broader point that I want to try to make with respect to the error of these rulings, is that parties have to be able to rely upon a consistent application of these rules. There may be very good strategic reasons why a party doesn't want or doesn't feel the need to take a deposition of a doctor. And in this case, we had a doctor who was testifying at trial, who had saw the plaintiff on three occasions, none of which was for the cervical spine, none of which was for the thoracic spine, a doctor who had never even seen him in clinic, had never followed, who never knew or was able to examine the plaintiff, and a doctor whose treatment was a year before the plaintiff even saw a neurosurgeon. So based upon the rules as they exist, we believed that Dr. Lanzikowski, that the deposition was unnecessary, because if the rules were applied in a way that they should have been, then he would have been limited to the testimony that he was going to give at trial. And that was the opinions, his treatment, okay, and the opinions he formed during his treatment, not with respect to medical records that he never saw. I mean,
go ahead and finish your answer, please.
Okay, thank you. Perhaps one of the most telling parts about Dr. Lanzikowski's treatment, and this goes to the past medical damages as well, not the future, but we objected to every line of questioning with respect to his review of medical records and bills that were never part of his file. He admitted on cross-examination that he was testifying that medical bills and these records from Southern Hills Hospital and the emergency room, they were all for injuries that were caused by this accident, and the bills were reasonable, necessary, and for injuries caused by this accident. Yet at the same time, he admitted that he had never even seen the records. He had no idea what actually was in the content of the records.
Okay.
And so
I think we understand, Mr. Meyer. We understand your position. Thank you again for your excellent argument, Mr. Levitt. As always, your excellent arguments before the court. We appreciate it very much, and we will take the case under submission, and we will be in recess till 1:30 this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.